Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Liz Pelka reporting. More than 100 dead in Pakistan. Officials in Pakistan say an overturned oil tanker burst into flames Sunday, killing at least 140 people, and that number expected to go up. At least 80 are injured. Many of them are in critical condition. Authorities say those killed and injured appear to have rushed to the scene to gather the leaking fuel. Reuters' Scarlett Sitinovich has more on the disaster.
The vehicle overturned after trying to make a sharp turn on a highway near the city of Bahawalpur. People had gathered to collect fuel when the tanker exploded, burning everyone on and around the spot. A rescue worker's spokesman says initial reports are that somebody tried to light a cigarette, catching spilt fuel alight, which led to the blast. Serious burn victims, several in critical condition, were airlifted to nearby hospitals. Firefighters fought the flames for over 2 hours before extinguishing the fire. A large number of other vehicles were also destroyed in the blaze.
Rescue workers in China are attempting to recover bodies Sunday following the deadly landslide in the southwestern province of Sichuan. Officials say 93 people remain missing after a huge landslide Saturday buried a mountain village in Mao County. Three people, a couple and their baby, were found alive immediately after the wall of rock and debris destroyed at least 40 houses, but no other survivors have been found. More than 3,000 people, police, soldiers, and civilians are participating in the rescue efforts, according to officials, and have been working nonstop to search through the rocks and rubble for survivors. We have more on this developing story on VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. In an interview Sunday, U.S. President Donald Trump says he and his Republican colleagues face a tough road ahead in their attempt to overhaul the health care system championed by former President Barack Obama. Senate leaders plan to vote Thursday on a measure that would end the requirement that Americans buy health insurance or pay a fine if they do not. The bill would also phase out federal subsidies to help lower-income people buy insurance. Supporters of the bill can only afford to lose two Republican votes, and already five Republican senators have said, count them out. President Trump will meet with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi for the first time on Monday. A White House spokesperson said he expects there to be a robust discussion between the two leaders. Economic deals and a joint statement about fighting terrorism are expected to be on the agenda. The visit will also involve the first dinner Trump will host at the White House for a foreign dignitary. Turkey's president says he will not pull Turkish troops from their base in Qatar. By doing so, he is rejecting a demand by major Arab states that it do so to end the ongoing crisis with the small Gulf country. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called the demand disrespectful. He said Turkey would not seek permission from others when making its defense cooperation agreements. The president had this to say about the 13-point demand list on Sunday as he left a mosque. Saying, we see the attitude regarding the 13 articles in contradiction with international law, because there cannot be such an attack on the rights of state sovereignty in laws between states. In fact, here we see an attack against a state's sovereignty rights. European Union leaders meeting in Brussels have agreed to greater cooperation as the continent grapples with a series of terror attacks. But little progress was made on their other challenges, including Brexit and the migration crisis. Prime Minister Theresa May said that her government will set out more detailed proposals for European Union citizens living in Britain on Monday. On the 67th anniversary of the beginning of the Korean War, the South's leader called on the North to stop its nuclear and ballistic missile development. South Korean Prime Minister Lee Nak-yeon encouraged denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula at a ceremony on Sunday. The Korean War ended in armistice in 1953. However, a peace treaty was never signed, leaving the two countries in a technical state of war. We have more on all these developing stories on VOAnews.com. I'm Liz Pelka in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Their role is to develop the national agenda, and that by doing so, they have to consult with all those who have taken arms against South Sudan. And at the end of the day, the President of the Republic has to accept the outcome.
The South Sudanese National Dialogue Committee consults former Affairs Vice President Dr. Riek Machar.
It is the government's policy, his own government's written policy, that the teenage pregnancies should not be a bar to girls resuming their classes and continuing with their education.
Tanzanian President John Magufuli comes under criticisms after saying pregnant teenagers should not be allowed back to public schools.
We were very surprised and shocked that the state changed course, basically dropping the first charge indictment against him and then bringing in another.
And a Sierra Leonean magistrate refuses to grant bail to opposition leader charged with armed possession. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Dr. Riek Machar, leader of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in Opposition, or SPLMIO, has accepted to be consulted on the process of the national dialogue aimed to help resolve the South Sudanese conflict. His acceptance came after leaders of the National Dialogue Steering Committee officially requested to get his views on the highly anticipated dialogue. Last month, President Salva Kiir launched the National Dialogue Initiative, but said Machar, his former Affairs Vice President, would not be part of the dialogue until he renounces violence. For more about the consultation of Dr. Riek Machar regarding the National Dialogue, I reach Atenyi Wek Atenyi, spokesman for President Salva Kiir in the capital, Juba.
The President agrees on that simply because this is within the mandate of the National Dialogue Steering Committee. They are free. Their role is to develop the national agenda. And that by doing so, they have to consult with all those who have taken arms against South Sudan. And at the end of the day, the President of the Republic has to accept the outcome of the Steering Committee recommendations.
Is the President still standing by his assertion that Dr. Riek Machar, his opponent, should renounce all violence before being included in this national dialogue?
The point of the President is clear. The side of Riek Machar, the opposition which is led by Riek Machar, has to be consulted also. But Riek Machar as a person should not come to join national dialogue because he has become synonymous with the fighting. And since the conducive atmosphere is actually wanted in the national dialogue and in the country, Riek Machar should not come himself. He can wait until 2018 when the elections are called for. From there, he can come to run for the election if he can renounce the violence. But before he renounces violence, he himself cannot come to participate in the national dialogue, but he can send a delegation that will represent him.
Critics of the president are saying, what is the president afraid of such that he will not allow Dr. Riek Machar, his opponent, to participate in a national dialogue aimed to end this conflict? Remember, the conflict since 2013 has led to tens of thousands of people being killed and over 2 million people being displaced from South Sudan. Why wouldn't he just go ahead, allow this man to be part of the dialogue if indeed it's aimed at resolving this conflict?
First of all, the president is not afraid, and he will never be afraid of anybody. The reason is, as you counted the number of the people so displaced and the people who have died and those who are actually now refugees outside, the president doesn't want to add more into that by allowing Riek Machar to come to Juba. Because if Riek Machar comes to Juba, as simple as you are saying, he will come here and regroup inside and make another fighting, whereby the number you just mentioned will swell. So for the interest of the country, as the president is the head of his state and is constitutionally mandated to protect the people of South Sudan, he cannot knowingly decide on something that will increase the suffering of the people of South Sudan. And so by accepting his duties as president, he He refused the participation of Riek Machar in person at the national dialogue just to protect the people of South Sudan, as the constitution requires.
But eliminating or deciding to push Dr. Riek Machar aside literally undermines the effort to end this burgeoning conflict in South Sudan. Why is he so adamant on insisting that he renounces violence before being included in this national dialogue? This is the question being asked by not only South Sudanese, by the international community as well.
Yeah, but what is to be understood by the international community is that when we say Riek Machar should not come in person, we are not just guessing. We have a history of a recent past, and we have tried, you know, time and again to see whether Riek Machar has changed or not. But quite often, he proves us right by doing what we think he can do. So for the interest of national dialogue, the president and the government of South Sudan has accepted to allow the delegation formed by Riek Machar to come to Juba, and they will be guaranteed the safety. They will come here, they will participate in the dialogue, and the outcomes of the national dialogue will pave the way for new South Sudan. So if Riek Machar is to be bold enough to send his delegation to Juba, as the chairman, the co-chairperson of the National Dialogue Steering Committee will be traveling to South Africa to meet Riek Machar, then Riek Machar would have done something good if he has to send the delegation.
Atain Wekatain is the spokesman for the South Sudanese President Salva Kiir. He spoke with me from Juba. Tanzanian civil society and women's groups have expressed outrage after President John Magufuli said teenage girls who get pregnant should not be allowed to return to public school. At a recent rally, the president warned that the pregnant teens will be distracted if they are allowed back to school after childbirth. But the opposing groups say the president's comments could end the education of many girls and propagate discrimination against the teenage mothers. The supporters of the president praised him for his bold pronouncement, saying it will help solve the country's growing teenage pregnancy problem. For reaction, I read Tundu Lissu, a parliamentarian from the Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema, in the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
The criticism against the president is completely justified. It is the government's policy, his own government's written policy, that the teenage pregnancies should not be a bar to girls resuming their classes and continuing with their education. It has been the policy of his government since he took over about 2 years ago. He inherited the policy from President Kikwete. It is a sound policy. It makes common sense. And now the president comes out and says exactly the opposite of what the government says in its policy documents. It's very strange. So the criticism against the president is completely justified.
But Mr. Lissu, a law was passed in 2002 which allows for the expulsion of pregnant schoolgirls in Tanzania. The law says that the girls can be expelled and excluded from school for offenses against morality and wedlock. Why hasn't this law been changed if you are sharply against it?
Well, it is not that we are sharply against it. Like I say, it is the government's own policy that these girls should be allowed to continue with their classes. When the president made his statement 3 days ago, he did not cite the law as the reason for saying that. It's just shot off from his head as he's wont to nowadays. Point is, we have a serious problem of teen pregnancies. We have possibly thousands of teenage girls who get pregnant when they are still in school. And to say that they should not continue with their education is making a big problem even bigger. It's not a solution.
But he thinks that these children or teenage mothers will be distracted in school because, of course, they have to go feed their children while in school, and that can be distracting. You don't think he has a point, do you?
I don't think he has a point, but today's newspapers here in town are citing the story of a girl who got pregnant when she was, you know, secondary three, and she's doing a PhD now. I'll tell you this, Peter. The best way of preventing girls from getting pregnant is dealing with the men who make them pregnant. As it is now, the girl gets pregnant, she's expelled from school, she cannot be allowed to continue with her studies, and the man goes scot-free. So if you're preaching morality, at least be consistent. Deal with the girls, deal also with the men.
The president is proposing at least 30 years jail sentence to men who impregnate teenagers in the country. Could that soon be taken up in parliament?
I don't know whether it will be taken up in parliament because we have not seen any legislative proposals to that effect. But let me tell you this, Peter, common sense demands that these girls be allowed to go to continue their studies so that they get some education to help themselves and to help their children. If you don't, you're just creating even bigger problems.
At least 8,000 Tanzania girls drop out of school every year due to teenage pregnancy. And supporters of the president are saying that he is a teacher. He has seen this firsthand. As a teacher, he's always a teacher, and that he has to come out sternly to warn teenagers that there are consequences to some of these actions and that your education could basically be curtailed. And they said he is justified.
Magufuli is not the only teacher we've ever had. Mwalimu Nyerere was a teacher too. There was a time when they used to prevent university students from continuing with education if they got pregnant. It was removed. And now it is Magufuli's own government policy that children who get pregnant in school should be allowed to continue with their education. Hiding behind the fact that he's a teacher. I was a teacher too. I taught before I went to college, you know. He's not the only teacher around. He's not the only person who knows a thing or two about morality. What we're saying is, how can you chuck out 8,000 students every year simply because they become parents? It doesn't make sense.
Tundu Lissu is a parliamentarian from the Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema. He spoke with me from Dar es Salaam. Sierra Leonean opposition leader Mohamed Kamarimba Mansere will spend the end of Ramadan at a prison in the eastern provincial city of Kenema. A magistrate refused to grant him bail at a hearing after the state announced new charges against the opposition leader. Kamarimba Mansere, the leader of the Alliance Democratic Party, was recently arrested on charges of possession of a small arm without license. But opposition groups say the charges against Mansere are politically motivated. To learn more about the new charges, I reached Emmanuel Safa Abdullahi, lead attorney for opposition leader Mohamed Kamarimba Mansere in the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown.
Well, we were very surprised and shocked that the state changed course, basically dropping the first charge indictment against him and then bringing in another. Clearly, we thought it was procedurally improper, and then we raised an objection against it. The sitting magistrate overruled the objection on the grounds that he thought it was proper for them to do what they did. But in the course of raising the objection, we actually raised constitutional question because we thought, I mean, his right to be properly investigated, interviewed, and his right to be cautioned for any offense for which he was going to be charged or be informed of the charges were all violated. So we basically asked him, the magistrate, to stay the question of law. Since it was a constitutional issue, he has no jurisdiction to sit on the constitutional issue. You know, and at that point, he basically went overboard. He was angry, he was shouting, and he said to me he was refusing bail or rescinding bail and adjourned the matter to the 28th.
Does that mean that him getting angry, refusing bail, your client, Kamarimba, will spend the end of Ramadan in jail?
Unfortunately, yes. And, you know, he's been fasting for the past 26 or so, 27 days. And he has to spend his Ramadan in jail because someone sitting somewhere wanted him to be in prison by that time. I don't think clearly there was any legal justification for refusing him bail. He has not jumped bail.
So what happened to the initial charge of acquiring an illegal weapon or a weapon that he did not register for which he was arrested? What happened to that charge?
Well, as usual, you know, when a political figure is arrested, and the time limit for holding him at the police station expires, they rush with a charge. So what they did with the initial charges was to bring an action, which were completely misplaced. Immediately when we looked at the indictment, we knew most of the laws that had been quoted, the Arms and Ammunition Act of 1955, another old law, most of the laws have been repealed. So I guess on second thought, they realized these charges would not have stood the test of litigation. So they changed the indictment. I mean, clearly they normally can do that. It's allowed in law for the prosecution to amend indictment against an accused person. But it is not allowable to replace or substitute the first indictment for another. Normally, you can get a discharge, you release the accused, and then the police can rearrest him and charge him to court because there's a constitutional requirement that you have to inform him of his rights.
So basically, you think his constitutional rights were violated. Some are also saying that, you know, the charges are politically motivated. As his defense lawyer, is this the stance that you have?
I don't like drawing inferences that I don't have conclusive facts on. Politically motivated could be something. He's a politician. He's been creating political waves all over the country. There are elections approaching. That could be something. I don't have evidence to that effect. But clearly, the manner in which the magistrate conducted himself were not only shocking, but they were completely wrong. And no other explanation could be given for it. Because this is a magistrate that had told us in the previous sittings that he was going to handle the matter in a free and fair manner. But all of a sudden, he changed it to something else. So, I mean, I don't have an explanation for that.
As a defense attorney, are you going to protest this move since you said your client's constitutional rights were violated?
Yeah, clearly. I mean, the first thing is we have filed papers for the High Court to look at the matter, whether he could have been refused bail. We hope that after the holidays, the High Court will sit on that. But clearly, the matter is now a constitutional question. The magistrate does not have any right to sit on that matter. So it's a constitutional matter that the Supreme Court will have to decide because we have raised constitutional issues.
Emmanuel Safa Abdullahi is the lead attorney for Sierra Leonean opposition leader Mohamed Kamarimba Mansere. He spoke with me from Freetown. Cameroon has dispatched the defense minister to the northern border with Nigeria following a string of suicide bomb attacks that left dozens dead. Militant group Boko Haram is believed to be behind the carnage. The Central African state says the bombers have infiltrated markets and mosques as the Ramadan feast draws near. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Mora in northern Cameroon.
Medical staff at the Mora Hospital on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria have attended to at least 50 people injured in 6 suicide bomb attacks in the towns of Mora and Kolofata within 24 hours. Among the medical staff brought in from the neighboring town of Marwa is Dr. Jean-Daniel Esam-Sime.
Il y a une dame qui est arrivée avec des plaies pénétrantes abdominales qui est arrivée en état de choc.
He says they are struggling to save the life of a lady who was brought to them with parts of her abdomen and legs cut off, as well as a breastfeeding 40-day-old baby whose hands were almost shattered. Among the wounded is 37-year-old self-defense group member Yunusa Usmanu. He says he got wounds from explosives detonated by one of the bombers. He says 2 of his colleagues died. Usmanu says he is going back to join other members of the self-defense groups in protecting their villages.
Comme la fête s'annonce, les membres du secte terroriste le Boko Haram sont là.
He says they noticed that attacks had increased during Ramadan and decided to assist the military by intensifying control along the border zones with Nigeria, where most of the suspects come from. He says they walk round the clock in groups of 10, dispatched to all road junctions and all entrances to their villages. Mijiyawa Bakari, governor of the far north region of Cameroon, says the 6 teenage suicide bombers, including 3 females, came from Nigeria to target areas with crowds of people. He says 15 suicide bomb attacks have killed dozens in Mora and Kolofata within the past 10 days.
Nous avons demandé à la police, à la gendarmerie, d'instituer des ceintures de sécurité.
He says while waiting for Cameroon's defense headquarters in Yaoundé to take more drastic measures to stop suicide bombing, he has instructed the military in this region to create security belts around border zones and in affected villages to assure the security of all. He says the military should double vigilance, be very rigorous in control, and seal all border zones used by suicide bombers. Musa Umaru, president of the Cameroon Association of Muslim Dignitaries and Imams, says they have sent members to the area to educate the population and instruct local Muslim clerics to be watchful. He says the attacks are increasing because terrorists use the holy month of fasting to deceive young Muslims that if they die fighting for Allah, they will go straight to paradise.
Le problème de fond, c'est qu'il faut développer un discours contre le discours des terroristes qui utilisent l'islam.
He says it is imperative for Muslim leaders to teach all of their faithful, especially the youths, that terrorists are using Islam to kill and destroy. He says the population should be made to understand that Islam is synonymous to peace and tolerance and has nothing to do with radicalization. Saturday, Cameroon dispatched its Minister of Defense, Joseph Betti Asomo, and its top military leadership to the northern border with Nigeria to reinstate peace and security as Muslims prepare to celebrate the end of Ramadan. The UNHCR reports that the Boko Haram insurgency in Nigeria and its spillover to neighboring Cameroon, Chad and Niger has caused the displacement of more than 2.7 million people and killed 25,000. Moki, Edwin Kinzeka, for VOA News, Mora, Northern Cameroon.
The Central African Republic government signed a peace deal in Rome with 13 of the 14 major rebel groups. The deal promised an immediate ceasefire in exchange for political representation. But as VOA's Zach Badoff reports from the capital Bangui, many people are not optimistic about the new accord.
The peace deal signed Monday is the latest in a series of pacts signed by armed groups in the Central African Republic. Three previous agreements, signed in 2014 and 2015, all fell apart. Igor Ako works at the U.S. Institute of Peace office in Bangui.
It's not the first agreement, but as one of the armed group representatives said, we have signed a good paper. But the only worry is that it can remain just a good paper.
Ako received word of the new deal while in Bamburi. He went directly to the representative of a local armed group.
So they are waiting for their representative to come back, and they will ask them about the content, and they will think if they fully agree, they fully follow, or they don't.
Just hours after the accord was signed, fighting broke out in the diamond mining hub of Bria. The town's mayor said more than 100 people were killed. Civil society members say they are most concerned about the new deal because it doesn't sufficiently address justice issues. Some worry it may eventually allow rebels to be granted amnesty, denying justice to victims of the crisis that escalated in recent months. Matthias Bartholomew Marumba heads up the Central African Human Rights Observatory.
Nous ne sommes pas contre leur accord, mais nous pensons que cet accord ne doit pas constituer une ombre.
He says, we are not against the deal, but we think the deal must not constitute a shadow for justice, and those who committed these reprehensible acts must be brought to justice. That's clear. Marumba criticized the United Nations peacekeeping force for not going after the rebel groups in the countryside more aggressively. On the streets of Bangui, 35-year-old maintenance worker Kevin Vreka agreed, saying he wants more done to force the rebels to stop fighting. He says the MINUSCA, the Congolese, the other people are there to secure the country. They are in the countryside, but they do nothing. The United Nations, what did it come to Bangui to do? To do nothing. To come with the vehicles and harass our women and everything else? Carlos Bunju, who works as a translator for a Chinese company in Bangui, called on armed groups to stop fighting. He had not heard of the peace deal, but doesn't expect it to make any difference.
Whatever they do, you know what I'm saying, nothing is going to change, you know what I'm saying? Because, like, some people, some armies, groups, they want a part, maybe, you know, some part in the government, but other people, they don't like, they're not going to allow them, and there's going to be fight over and over.
Zach Badwar for VOA News, Central African Republic.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In the Confederation Cup in Russia, Cameroon's hopes of progressing to the next stage were dented by a 1-1 draw with Australia on Thursday. The Indomitable Lions took the lead at the end of the first half when Andre Frank Zamba scored his first international goal. But Australia's captain equalized from the penalty spot in the 60th minute after Alex Gashpak was brought down inside the box. The draw makes it very unlikely that the African champions will progress to the next round. They face Germany in their final group game in Sochi tonight, Sunday, while Australia play Chile at the same time in Moscow. The Cameroons have to beat the reigning champions and hope other results go their way. In boxing, WBA, WBC, and IBF middleweight champion Gennady Golovkin has dismissed the idea that Floyd Mayweather's comeback fight against UFC champion Conor McGregor will overshadow his highly anticipated fight with Saul Canelo Alvarez. Triple G is quoted telling the media that his is the true boxing fight, as opposed to what he called the circus show of Mayweather-McGregor. The 35-year-old Kazakh has an unbeaten record of 37 fights, with 33 coming by way of knockout. The Triple G-Alvarez fight is highly anticipated to decide the world's best middleweight. The light middleweight fight between Mayweather and the Irish McGregor could earn both men as much as $100 million. And in athletics, it was a hectic 2 days in Nairobi as Kenya's cream de la cream of distance running talents took to action in Kenya's World Championships trials. The last two IAAF World Cross Country Champions, Agnes Tirop and Irene Cheptai, produced the highlight of the day Friday in the women's 10,000 meters. With a small field of 8 athletes starting the race, and the top three automatically qualifying for the team bound for the World Championships London 2017, Jebet overtook Cheptai with only 150 meters to go on to win the race. Cheptai was second, and Eprot confirmed her spot on the national team, finishing third. In the men's events, there was a deep 5,000 meter field with 15 athletes at the start. Cyrus Ruto, the second fastest Kenyan this year over the distance, used the last lap to take the win and qualify for the IAAF World Championships. Davis Kiplangat, the 2015 World Silver Medalist, was a close second, securing his spot for London. Road race specialist Geoffrey Koech was third, but still has run the qualifying standard of 13.22 to validate his ticket on the team. And that's all the time we have for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now, back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Na pia navyo piga gita. Na una watu mependeza.
nyonso zao zimeja fura. Kitatokea nini? Najua ujue leo hii. Nitakwambia nini darling? I do this for you, this for you. 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 Wanapenda kukuona wewe ukiwa na furaha. Najua thamani na heshima yako. Hakia Mungu we ni mzuri. You're so beautiful. Na Mungu kakujalia. Hauna chembe ya kiburi. We ni msafi wa roho. I don't wanna let you go. I wanna marry you girl. And nothing comes between us. I'm gonna give you my loving and make them wanna be us. I do this for you, this for you. I do this for you, this for you. I do this for you, this for you. Namuomba Mungu, yeah. Akulinde, yeah. Akutunze na watoto nilete. Wewe ni furaha yangu, maisha yangu. Niwe wanapenda kukuona wewe ukiwa na furaha. Najua thamani na heshima yako unanifaa.
Yeah. like a baby to a mother. Me love you, me no need no other. Me woulda rather take you to me father. A baby to a mother. Me love you, me no need no other. Rather take you to me father. To me father. A 1+1 that on me and you. Me and you coulda make it true. They must know see me in a lot with you. With you, yeah. Ha! Nah, deny. You must have suckled with that. In the balance of Terere, Terere, Nango Terere. Terere. Some money all the way. I know say.
Here's another one. Here's another one. Touch.
More call. See the money no matamu. Wako nikaja chezea, nika kueka moyo, nika kuna muimu. Kumbe unapita njia. Kila kivuta pita, naona kama ni wewe. Ani wewe Kila pita kivuta, naona kama ni wewe. Likese kimwomba Mola atanipenda busara wenazo mimi melala lala asidanganye na hela kama ni upendo wangu tugaone nilipofika hewama ninachojali tuelewane kila kivuta pita naona kama ni wewe ani wewe kila pita kivuta naona kama ni wewe.
Make them boogie down, let's say that me they make them go low.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The South African Constitutional Court, the highest legal authority, exercised restraint last week when it refused to get itself embroiled in a dispute between the South African Parliament and President Zuma. With mounting allegations of corruption, state capture and maladministration, there have been many demands that President Zuma should resign as state president. As a consequence, the opposition parties in parliament had demanded that the highest court in the land should order the parliament to conduct its vote on the vote of confidence against the government of President Zuma. The Constitutional Court said it could not order such a vote of secrecy, but said that it is the Speaker of Parliament that could order or deny the issue of secret ballot during the vote of no confidence. This is, in fact, quite elementary, and such a thing could be found in many parliaments. One wonders why the opposition parties in South Africa resorted to the court to make a purely political decision. The issue now is what will happen when the question of vote of confidence comes up soon in the parliament. There are two scenarios. The Speaker of the Parliament could indeed decide to conduct a secrecy vote, but this is certainly will be challenged by a representative of the ANC, and this then will be voted on in open vote, and the result is very clear. Such a secret vote by Parliament would be rejected. The other scenario is the Speaker would suggest that the vote be open and a representative of the opposition, the Democratic Alliance, could challenge the Speaker, and again there would be an open vote to support or reject the ruling of the Speaker. In either case, it is very clear that there would be no secret ballot in the decision on vote of no confidence. But the South African media, and in fact some international media, misread the decision of the Constitutional Court. They saw its ruling as a defeat for President Zuma, which definitely it is not. The issue then is, why does the opposition, particularly the Democratic Alliance, persist in getting the court embroiled in its dispute with President Zuma? Furthermore, why is the media so one-sided in its analysis of the dispute between President Zuma and its opposition? The real reason is this. Many of those in the media and opposition are worried as to who will be the next president of the ANC when its Congress meets in December to select one person. There are generally four serious candidates for the job. One of them is Dr. Zuma, who has just resigned as the chairperson of the African Union. The next is the Vice President, Cyril Ramaphosa. If you look at the division in the parliament of those who support or oppose Zuma, you will find that in the ANC, three entities support Cyril Ramaphosa as the next president of the ANC: COSATU, the South African Communist Party, and some prominent cabinet ministers. On the other hand, those who support Dr. Zuma are mainly the party stalwarts and leaders in the provincial structure of the ANC. This is the struggle, and they would like to weaken President Zuma to prevent his former wife, Dr. Zuma, from becoming the new president of the ANC, which will virtually mean that she would become the next president of South Africa when elections take place in 2019. So this is the central issue. And one can see that, for example, last week, the Youth League of the ANC nominated Dr. Zuma, and she accepted that. Previously, both COSATU and the Communist Party have sided with Cyril Ramaphosa. So we will see this struggle go on. President Zuma, in reacting to the constitutional ruling, made a pertinent remark. He said that the decision or the call for secret ballot is unfair because the opposition, particularly the Democratic Alliance, is searching for a majority which it doesn't have. And that, in fact, the real issue. And now, to show the cynicism of the opposition, the Democratic Alliance has said it doesn't matter whether or not there is a secret ballot, that what they want to do and they believe they will get is to oust President Zuma as state president. We have to watch this very carefully because it may have fundamental impact on Africa. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if the fight is tomorrow, then why should you clench your fist today? I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Across South Sudan, Yemen, Nigeria, and Somalia, 20 million people are at risk for famine, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Nikki Haley. Speaking recently in New York at a U.N. Security Council open ARIA formula meeting on the risk of famine in Yemen, Somalia, South Sudan, and northeast Nigeria, Ambassador Haley warned, in Nigeria, those who have liberated towns from Boko Haram have reportedly discovered people eating grass and bugs off the ground. In Yemen, families cannot afford to pay for the transportation of their starving children to the few treatment centers that are still open. In Somalia, some mothers are forced to walk more than 100 miles with their crying children just to find a reliable source of food and water. In Nigeria, South Sudan, Yemen, and Somalia, she said, people are not dying from some natural disaster, but from something man-made, armed conflict. Since last fall, the United States has given more than $1 billion in assistance to these four countries. In 2017, the United States has provided one quarter of the humanitarian funding for these countries, according to UN data. The United States will continue to lead in bringing together resources to help overcome this crisis. And, as we heard today, others are stepping up too, with the World Bank expanding its operations to include famine response for the first time. These funds provide food and clean water, specialized nutrition and medical care, shelter, education, protection, and other life-sustaining services. Access, the ambassador noted, remains a key obstacle. Because of war, food cannot reach the people who need it. In South Sudan, Yemen, and Nigeria, warring parties need to let the food in. In Somalia, the challenges caused by years of conflict with terrorist organizations are compounding the impact of a drought. So the answer to famine is not rocket science. The answer is that we must put pressure on armed groups to allow food into places that don't have it. The U.S. calls on the U.N. Security Council to hold all governments accountable when they refuse to allow access to help their people in need. The longer we wait to act, said Ambassador Haley, the higher the cost.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.